Welcome to the Life Self-Mastery podcast, where we bring in entrepreneurs who have created online businesses and improved their lifestyles. Here's your host, Rohit Malhotra.
Hi, everyone. This is Rohit from Life Self-Mastery, and today I'm excited to have Stephen Ross, who's the head of partnerships at Pigment, where he focuses on sales and go-to-market strategy. He had earlier worked with companies like Celonis, JP Morgan, and Meltwater. Stephen did his master's from University of Edinburgh. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Hi, thank you so much, Rohit. Real pleasure to be here. And I'm excited to have a good chat with you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we had a couple of good discussions, you know, prior to this. And congratulations on the partnership with Deloitte. I think that's something which is quite interesting.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, it's been in the works for a while. As with all these announcements, you know, there's sort of months of undertone of work that goes into it. But yeah, it's certainly the very beginnings of what will be a fruitful partnership for us at Pigment.
Yeah, quite. You know, I saw one of the articles from Akash Bajwa, who's a VC here in the UK, and you know that is how, you know, I got in touch with you. But let's talk about, you know, how did you get in this crazy world of, you know, partnerships and startups? What got you interested to get into the world of partnerships?
Well, it's a good question. It's a very good question. I think my landing into partnerships was a little bit unorthodox, to say the best. I studied business, and I've always had a very curious mind. So I focused on venture creation, innovation, entrepreneurship. And when I first graduated, you know, I was looking at, okay, if I wanted to build my own business, what are the types of skills and experiences that would be most valuable to me? And I looked at some early kind of study that was suggesting that 20% of CEOs had a background in sales. So I was like, right, yeah, sales, that's definitely for me. I went into SaaS and was a kind of mid-market AE where I was having to prospect and build my own book of business and accounts. And then I had a kind of after my year sort of baptism of fire into how you sell, learning how to sell, I decided to pivot. And I was actually in JP Morgan looking at kind of financial tax regulation and compliance with internal business process, which is about as dry as it sounds, Rohit. Going to lie. So I was there very briefly, and I had a contact of mine from university approach me and said, we have a company, Pure Li-Fi, 15 people, and we're looking to get our first sort of client-facing commercial hire. Effectively, unbelievable technology where you can connect wirelessly through lights instead of radio frequency. I mean, certainly one of the most incredible technologies I've had the privilege of coming across. And they said, how can we build a go-to-market with it? How can we do it? And I was like, this is right up my street. I need that sort of creative environment. I like the problem solving, super curious. I'm going, okay. So I've got a situation here where I've got a product which has never been invented before. I mean, it's unbelievable. First of its kind, where, okay, I can connect wirelessly to the internet via an LED light. Why on earth? Why would I do that? What's the point? Well, you start to look at, okay, well, what are the environments where today's radio frequency are having challenges? They're difficult. So you're thinking, okay, well, what about high security? So issues with, you know, radio frequency passes through walls. So you think of military, you think government, you think kind of specific use cases, and you're going with light, the physics of it pertains that it can be contained into the cone of light, really specific. So you're going, okay, wow, well, that's a kind of physical advantage you have. And then you go, what about interference? That's another thing as well. And you've got loads of connected radio frequency devices. And by the way, there's a long, long answer to your question. I will come back to it. I will come back to it. There is a point here. Right. So then I started building a go-to-market around kind of DoD, MOD, into some automotive organizations. So I actually did a deal with BMW where on the shop floor, there was lots of autonomous robots all kind of connected through radio frequency. And every time you had interference, they had downtime of 60 seconds or so or more. And for every second that it was down, the production line was stopped, orders were not going out. So an easy business case, how can we offload that? So I love that. One of the biggest challenges I had there, and this is the tangential into partnerships, was I have to work out, how do I build these devices? How do I work with lighting organizations to actually build the LED infrastructure? How do I work with telecom operators to obviously work the actual regulated, unregulated spectrum? And suddenly I was like, I'm having to connect all of these dots of an eco. First time I was kind of building this ecosystem subconsciously. It was like these lighting manufacturers with the likes of Zumtobel in Austria, third largest lighting organization in the world. And I was looking at how do I build ruggedized kind of physical devices that are kind of going into tablets, so on. And suddenly I was having to look at all of this big ecosystem and connect the dots. And I was going, it sort of came quite naturally. So then when I was there, Celonis approached me and they'd asked, okay, we're looking to build out a whole new go-to-market, a whole new revenue channel around selling to our ecosystem, selling to consultants. We're looking for someone that just knows how to build a revenue stream, whilst also understanding these are not just customers, they're partners of ours. And I'm going, that is exactly what I know how to do. So that was the sort of tangential into Celonis, where I started actually still on a sales front, going actually and building a revenue channel to these partners. And then from there, I was realizing that the way that I was working with them, the way I was always considering what I'm selling, whatever I'm selling to you, how does that impact the relationship you have with the Celonis AEs? How does that impact the relationship you have with delivery and professional services? How does that impact your broader business case? I was thinking about not just the sell to, but the sell through and the sell with, and the broader impact it has across the organization. And that was my transition into partnerships, where I was like, okay, well, I'm interested in how you are impacting our entire go-to-market. Not one motion, not one cycle, the whole end-to-end. And that's where I've spent the last now 5 years very much focused on building these go-to-markets with not just consulting organizations, but broad partners. So anyway, that's the long answer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love the answer. So yeah, you made a jump from sales to partnerships, but I've also seen BD guys making a shift into partnerships. What advice would you give to listeners, who are fresh out of college or have had a couple of years experience, and they would want to get into partnerships? Do you think they should start with sales and marketing and then get into partnerships? And what's the best way forward?
I don't think there's one answer. Is that I have certainly worked with people in partnerships that have come from being an SA, being in professional services, being in marketing, or being in sales, or being in pre-sales. It's common because the partnerships are touching the end-to-end go-to-market. I would say that the biggest prerequisite I have is somebody that can be curious and strategic enough to take a step back and understand how an entity outside your organization is touching your end-to-end go-to-market. Now, if you have that curiosity and that interest, then certainly partnerships is a good place to be. And I wouldn't be, if you're coming out of university and you want to work in partnerships, then look for a job in partnerships. You don't have to go through this tangential. You can, and there's no harm to it. But the path doesn't have to be linear in that respect. So when you look at, there's a lot of organizations that are looking, say, for interns within the partner ecosystem, or there's kind of graduate entry jobs into partner operations, or even partner development managers or partner activation managers, and looking at that first rung in the step of knowing you want to work in partnerships. And I think that because partnerships are probably one of the more immature facets of a go-to-market, that a lot of people have fallen into partnerships later in their career, or they've gone through one of these other paths. But if someone is at university and knows that's what they want to go to, then go for it. That's my kind of advice for it.
Got it. Interesting. And earlier we had a discussion about your experience in Celonis, but how was the experience working with Celonis? And you also did work in Germany, how was the experience there versus out here in the UK?
Yeah, so first question, just for Celonis, it was a great experience. I'd describe it as a bit like a pressure cooker. I was there for 4 years, employee number 500. We scaled to about 3,000 plus people, $1 billion valuation to $13 plus billion valuation. And for me, it was a delight to be in a place that matched my own ambition. I'm always someone that said, well, why not? Why can't you change the way that the world does business? Why can't you change the approach? Why not? And to be in a place that was actually matching and wanted to build a whole category of software that never existed, company had no budget for, that was honestly a treat. In terms of the culture side, it was interesting because being based in Germany in Celonis, it was a very international experience. So our outlook of everyone working there was international outlook, was having the sort of same problem-solving hat. And I think that generally, what I'm seeing through the generation coming up now is that often you'll see with in terms of cultural divide, you'll see just as much cultural divide on sort of level of experience as you will with different geographies. What I mean by that is that if you look at young people now, how are they consuming information? Snapchat, TikTok, Facebook.
Yeah.
I mean, Snapchat maybe is my, showing my age, and Facebook, but TikTok. So they're consuming information in a very similar way. So, and I think that one of those, the way in which you consume information is often one of those leading indicators for the kind of cultural shifts, mm-hmm. right, and change. And
yeah.
I think that's why you might often see someone who's 25 who's from Germany or from UK or from India or from China or from Brazil having a lot more in common than someone that's, say, 25 to 65 years old. And
yeah.
I think that way, so generally, I think that I've noticed that with the generation coming through. But no, being in Salonis, I think it's similar to the culture I see even at Pigment, which is,
right.
hey, it's not about being German. It's not about being, it's about building a company that can ultimately change the way in which people, in which organizations are working.
Right.
But I did hear anecdotally working for Siemens or BMW might be a different experience.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's quite fascinating that you have that sort of very interesting international experience. And, you know, and following up on that, you know, a bit of a story about myself. I came to the UK. I studied very near to London because I thought, you know, most of the job opportunities over there. But very interestingly, you are based out of Edinburgh. And we had a discussion about the UK ecosystem. And, you know, I could be wrong. I've been here for a short while, but I've seen that the UK startup ecosystem is quite, you know, focused on London, which is quite interesting. But what do you think about the UK startup ecosystem and what needs to be done to in order to build ecosystems out of London?
So yeah, it's a great question. Quite a loaded one. So I'll try and give it my best answer. It's a certainly a complex issue that the UK has.
Yeah.
My short answer is that there's a massive opportunity, absolutely massive. Give or take, there's about 70 million people in the UK, and I think that you're absolutely right with your observation. It's hugely centralized, and I would say that certainly in the developed world, the UK is probably the most centralized union or series of construct of countries in the developed world. So if you look at not just tech, look at fashion, look at politics, look at just culture, entertainment, look at which finance, look at any, just name one, and it's there. Now
right.
That's kind of unusual for most countries. I mean, especially when I was living in Germany, where you're kind of going, well, you were obviously building a company in Munich. Nobody questioned you building in Munich. Obviously,
yeah.
before then, you're thinking it was more Berlin as the startups ecosystem community. You know, Frankfurt is the home of finance, really, for Germany. You've got Cologne and kind of North Rhine-Westphalia is obviously a massive industrial hub, massive, massive. Hamburg as well. I think the second or third largest port in Europe. So it kind of dispersed across the country, and I think that provides a wealth of opportunity that you don't create a society in where you can't build success and have wealth creation in different places. I think that the UK has had a philosophy of sort of centralization of wealth, and it trickles down, which, as
right.
we know doesn't work, but that's in the DNA of the kind of the holistic culture of the entire UK, which is that if you don't concentrate it in one place, it won't be a success. And I think that that's one of the biggest challenges that you have to overcome here, which is that post-digitization, this is wonderful. Look at us having a conversation. You're beside me in London, and I'm up in Edinburgh. I'm working remotely with a MIA and APAC-wide job with a company that's headquartered in Paris. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
And that's the difference now, is that I think that the biggest shift has to be in people recognizing that why not? Like, why can't I build a big success story out of Manchester, out of Leeds, out of Newcastle, of Edinburgh, Glasgow, Inverness, why not?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, when I look at success stories like in Estonia, I think they've got the most startups per capita anywhere in the world.
Sure.
And you look at Bolt, you look at TransferWise, you look at what they did with Skype and with Hotmail. And this is a
right.
country of 1.3 million people, because
yeah.
there they've got great, great institutions like Tartu, and then you've got Tallinn, and you can build a company. Nobody's questioning why not. Whereas here, I remember when I was at university exploring building my own company, the advice I was given from a mentor was, you will never, ever make a success in the UK if it's not in London. And I'm going, wow, Imagine telling someone 18, 19 years old that they'll never make a success. Whereas if you look at, say, actually, it was interesting. I was looking just recently, look at the 30 biggest companies in the United States. They're represented in 16 different states.
No.
16.
Yeah.
16. You think, oh, it must all be in California or New York. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
16 from Arkansas, Minnesota to New York, California, and Texas. Why not? And I think that, you know, it takes that ecosystem of entrepreneurs to challenge the status quo, have the gravitas and have the mental fortitude to go, why not? Yes, I can build a company here.
Yeah.
From where I am in Edinburgh, I have eight universities within 1 hour of me. Eight.
Yeah.
Some of the oldest and most prestigious universities, certainly in the UK.
True.
And I've got all this wealth of talent being churned out. I think the Institute for AI is the oldest in Europe, 1963, I think it is.
Well.
With this wealth of talent coming every single year, but not being retained and going pulled down. So I think for me, the opportunity is massive. The talent is there. It takes the people to challenge the status quo. Also for VCs and for NP to understand that from the outside, because I understand that that's just in the UK. When you're outside, the assumption, I think you made that assumption too. The assumption is, well, I have to be in London.
Yeah,
The
true.
degree is true, but that's not the full truth. And it takes people to realize that you can build a company outside. So anyway, that's a
Yeah.
few of my own thoughts.
Yeah. And interestingly, you also made a interesting point that you have lot of product and tech talent in Edinburgh. So and maybe, if people are looking to build products, maybe they should look at outside of London ecosystem. And maybe, bit of a capital also needs to go into these cities so that more founders can go there and start building.
Yeah, I totally agree. And who are you selling to? If you're only selling to London, makes sense. But if your audience, you're selling to, why not?
Absolutely. So, I want to talk about partnerships. So when it comes to, in simple terms, what are the common misunderstandings or oversimplifications about alliances which comes in the business world?
I think one of the most common misconceptions is that they say partnerships, oh, that's a top of funnel activity. That's just top of funnel.
Yeah.
And, my only measurement of partnerships is sourced opportunities or influenced ACV. And another one is being that partnerships, it doesn't really translate into meaningful impact on the business. It's sort of fluffy. And I think that's very surface level. For me, when I'm looking at partnerships, it's okay, top of funnel and funnel, out of funnel. I'm looking at across the board. I'm saying, okay, well, yeah, you can easily measure sourced opportunities coming from partners or sourced closed opportunities from partners. And that's be it consulting, tech partnerships, cloud marketplace. But you're going, okay, well, what about your win rate when you partner? And what about your average deal size? And what about your average sales cycle length? And what about your cost of sale? And what about your cost of retention? And what about, I mean, suddenly you have to talk about meaningful business metrics that are impacted by partnerships. And I think that one of the common misconceptions is, oh, yeah, they're just bring me leads. That's what you do.
Leads and revenue.
Yeah, the leads are revenue. I mean, yeah, sure, but like you're going to be missing quite a bit in the middle if that's all you're measuring.
Right, got it. And I've heard a lot of partnership managers say that a company is not partner or partner ready, and they're not partner fit. What sort of internal culture should a company embrace so that they are partner first strategy?
First question, understand what do you want from partners? What do you want from partnerships? It's like the first basic question. Is partnerships, and we were talking about this earlier, it's hugely convoluted. I've got consulting partnerships with boutique and RSI and GSIs, I've got tech partnerships, I've got cloud marketplace alliances, I might have an academic alliance, and then you've got different motions, referral, co-sell, resell. I could build assets with partners to expand use case offerings rather than say just looking to resell an existing product. They're huge. So the question is, well, what do you want from them? And I think that once you understand that, then you can better orient your business for success. And the orienting your business for success and partnerships is that's the bit that's being partner first. And you can't do that without executive buy-in. So what I mean is like structural alignment. I'll give some examples. So if I'm working with a consulting partner, I have to be understanding that their business is built on services. I don't want their business built on something else. I want it built on services. So if I'm an executive in a company and I plan to build out and scale out my professional services capacity, I'm doing that in the knowledge it stifles business cases at these partners here who can help me, you know, with my win rates, with deal sizes. They might bring me opportunities as well. It can be right across there. It's impacting. So for me, being partner first is that alignment at the very top, and then having across the different go-to-market functions, structural alignment that, hey, when I work with partners, we need to be considered of their business case and how they work and how they measure success just as much as we are. And I think that's the bit that often companies don't quite understand yet.
Yeah. So what you're saying is you need to first have a buy-in from the executive leadership team and from C-suite so that they understand, you know, what they want from partnerships, and you know, when they're looking to recruit somebody in partnerships, or they want to partner their strategy. Yeah.
Absolutely. And earlier the better. Earlier the better. I mean, the later you're on your journey, of course it can be done, but then you've built in so many behaviors and habits, and you're basically trying to bring in a whole new way of working. So for me, I can say is that if you're a partner first, when we hire sales, part of the criteria and the ask is, well, what's your experience working with partners? How can I qualify how partner-oriented you'll be? Rather than say bring in sales and say, no, I like to do direct. I don't like to give ownership of a sales cycle in any mean. I go, well, that's going to be quite difficult then to build a partner-first culture. So you have to think of it in every little facet of your go-to-market.
Got it. Interesting. And you know, especially when it comes to starters, they do start off with single product, but then, you know, how does the shift happen for partnerships when they're going from single product to multi-product platform?
So I'm going to make, again, have me a couple assumptions. So let's say, take the example, let's say SaaS, and let's say I've got single product and my multi-product would be an adjacent space. I'm going to assume it's going to be adjacent, right? I'm not going to go too far. So now, it again, when you talk about partnerships, it all depends on, say, well, who am I selling to? Let's say if I'm selling into the enterprise, say, you know, big segment, big organizations. I'll explain back to front how this impacts a partnership. So if I'm the CFO, and let's say I'm assuming I'm selling a software or a hardware or a tool or something into the CFO's office, what are their problems if they're a big company? Their problems are not point-to-point solutions. He probably isn't, they probably have no idea, he or she, or they have no idea what the specificities of the tool is that is downstream there. And I'm a 50,000 person organization. They're thinking, well, I just see my cash flow. I've got an issue with my cash flow preservation. I've got an issue with my working capital optimization. I've got a problem with the percentage points of my profitability. So who are they going to turn to? They turn to their trusted advisor. They turn to likely their consultant partner or a strategic consultant partner and say, well, how can I resolve that? And they'll see that that's the part, the seeds of the finance transformation or the broader digital transformation that transcends multi-tech stack. Now, likely the vendor's tool is sitting somewhere in one of these tech stacks somewhere. The question is, how can you make sure that you're a tool in their toolbox, top of mind, that every time they're thinking to the CFO's office, that you're at the heart of this? And if you have multi-product to answer the question now, all you're doing is taking a larger piece of that transformation. So to the consultant, if you're telling them, hey, I can actually do this part of the problem and I can do this part as well, well, happy days. Fantastic. That just translates into more value for the client, more value for the consultant, more value for you. So certainly the way of partnering is very much the same, but every time you look at that multi-product, you're asking yourself the exact same question. How does my product roll up into the fundamental problems of the executive persona that I'm looking to sell to? How does it do that?
Got it. And especially, you know, when you talk to CROs, and if they have a multi-product, you know, they need to create, you know, different sales teams, and, you know, different go-to-market teams for each of the products. Because what happens with sales guys is if they're comfortable selling something, they keep selling that. But do you see that the same problem with partnerships? Do you need to have a different partnership team for each product?
Generally no. Generally no. It can be centralized. And my view here is that when you're selling multi-product, very rarely will it all be rolled out in simultaneously. Very rarely. So if I take even in like Pigments world, you have a planning tool, but then you've got consolidation, right? So of course you're going to have, if we actually even add more, we'll partner with someone that say does consolidation, we are the planning tool, and then you're going to have the consultancy, so you've got three in a box that's there. right? Connecting those two together. So you're actually saying there's two different sales teams plus a consultant. So the same premise applies. It's just external rather than internal. And the view is, well, the consultancy is there to support and manage that process. You will have, say, and the thing is, if you have, and this is the one thing, is if you're getting a bit bigger as an organization and you've got a massive opportunity, you will likely have a point of contact leading an account. So let's say I have a Siemens and it's a big account. I will likely have an AE that owns that account. And then they will be responsible for the multitude of products that get sold in, if it's big enough, assuming that if you're multi-product, you might have that. If not, then it would be a coordination with the consultancy. But in the same vein, take the extreme and say a Deloitte, you have an LCSP or a Cal in Accenture, the lead client service partner that owns that account. And Deloitte have probably a myriad of services they can give into a particular account, particular client. So how do they coordinate? Well, they'll have one person there and they'll be the gatekeeper to all of the ownership of the problems of that company. So there's a couple different ways you can play it. And generally from a partnerships function, it can still be managed by the same centralized partner team, but it requires that partner to have the overarching understanding of that partner and making sure that they're connected internally to the right people.
Okay, got it. And just to follow up on that, do you also do the scoring for your partners? And, you know, is that, you know, how do you get to, you know, check the metrics and see that
in
if
terms
the partner's
of
happy?
Scoring in terms of their which respect?
You know, about the relationship and if they're happy.
Well, actually, funny, that's something we're actually looking at the moment, is that I think it's so, so important. In the same vein where you have, say, customer success, and you look at sort of a CSAR NPS, and you look at generally the satisfaction of that customer with yourself, the same should be done on an annual basis with a partner. Because like for us, what's core, and I always talk about this, is being easy to do business with. We have to be straightforward to do business with, and the best way to do that is have the feedback, have the open dialogue. So I think having it formally done annually, where you have that kind of scorecarding of how you are to partner with from the other perspective, is important. But generally, I see as well with partner managers that are very successful, they have open dialogue all the time, all the time, all the time. But I think formally is a great way to do it.
Got it. And especially, you know, somebody who's new into partnerships, you know, what are the different type of alliances which they should know about and which are important in, you know, business ecosystems?
Great question. So I would say, I mean, I generally, you'll hear me saying this multiple times. I try to simplify it down, because again, partnerships is complex, it's convoluted, highly matrix. So nice and simple. I think for most, especially for technology companies, say like a Celonis, you have kind of three core buckets: consulting, technology partnerships, and then I give their own is the sort of cloud and marketplace alliance. Yeah. So you say, okay, well, I have, you know, my relationship with AWS or Microsoft for Azure, or maybe GCP with Google, and obviously getting on their marketplace and looking to push as much, obviously, and working with the organization to have additional credits so that they can use that as a route of a mechanism to pay and to manage that as a go-to-market is one area. Tech partnerships, again, I use the example like Pigment with consolidation, or maybe partnering with likes of Workiva, or you have alliances that or Celonis had the same with ServiceNow. Look at companies that are saying, okay, you sit adjacent to me. Maybe I see it serve CFO's office. You see it serve CIO's office. We have complementary solutions. I think that adds a much, much powerful, more powerful argument to the transformation. So managing that technology partner, and it has its own pros and cons, right? The pro is certainly that they speak the same language. I speak ACV and ARR, and you know, I speak that language. I speak to your quarters. Your quarters mean something to me. And then you've got consulting partners, which is also quite has its own subset. So maybe boutique consultancies that have their own specialization on maybe your own, say, market or technology. You'll have kind of RSIs that maybe have obviously larger organizations that can cover maybe just advisory, change management. They'll also be there maybe doing some tool selection organizations. And then you'll have your sort of GSIs, the big ones, the sort of headline grabbers like Deloitte and Accenture, so on. And I think that's another bucket in its own right. And they have their own motions for how you'd work with them. But that's generally the sort of simplified three buckets I'd put it in.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love that, you know, how you put in those buckets. But, you know, somebody who's just starting off in a new role on a new project, you know, how do you get to decide, you know, which a land they should invest in, and you know, what metrics should they look at for success?
If you're talking about somebody joining a company, like, or are you talking about the organization themselves, like how they measure, or?
I mean, for organizations, you know, what metrics they should look at to check the success.
So if it's an organization, just trying to, again, there's no right and wrong where you start. Right. Where you go. There's no right and wrong. That's firstly really be clear. I think the biggest mistake you can make is trying to do everything. That's the biggest mistake. It's a heavy lift, and partner people are not magicians. Some things that just take time.
Yeah.
And you're basically having to reorient an entire go-to-market around even one of those pillars. So I think that going back to the earlier question of, okay, well, what do you want from your partner go-to-market? What's your ultimate goal here? And again, that will then help to inform the decision of which of these buckets that I'm going to lead with. And then what are the leading indicators for success? So you might say, again, going back to, say, consulting, it's okay, well, you know, my challenge at the moment is I'm a small company. Maybe I'm a new company and I'm growing quickly and nobody knows who I am. Nobody knows who I am. So that third party validation is really valuable, really valuable. And you go, well, that makes a lot of sense. So I would like to partner because I believe that they will help me with my win rates. I believe I'll get better success with that. My deal sizes, maybe they'll help to expedite the sales cycle length because I won't need to go through as many internal checks at that client because they trust not just me, but also that third party advisor that is to them, you know, and maybe that'll help. So you go, all right, okay. So this is a route you can go down. So then you go, okay, well, then you've got your boutiques, your RSIs and GSIs. Each of them, they become more slower moving or more difficult to get going in the beginning, you know, depending on how big they are. So you might say, okay, well, this partner here, this small boutique partner is highly credible with this specialized use case, hugely credible. And I'm getting a lot of traction on that use case. So I want them not just because I want them to help me source opportunities because they've got relationships. I want them because they can help me win more. They will help me win bigger and help me win more. And that's what I'm going to measure. I'm going to measure not just them, but I'm going to measure that success of the consulting motion with my fledgling startup as a company with the ability to scale with those partners.
Got it. And especially, you know, when you're working with a lot of partners, you know, especially in big companies like Celonis and Bigmint, how do you align those incentives so that, you know, you're able to get the best out of, you know, the partners and the integrator that you're working with?
Yeah. For me, I'll say the same to you. I say to the team, I say to people externally, I'm very consistent. I'm transparent. Is that you have to be open with your partner go-to-market. They are not exclusive to you. Most of them. Most of them are not exclusive to you. So they're agnostic. Their job is to be the trusted advisor for their client. And that's what I want them to be. In the same vein, they play within a, what we call, say, a Pigment partner universe, or they play within an ecosystem. They play within a space that requires boutiques, it requires RSIs, it requires GSIs, and they all play a complementary role. The question, how much is too much, is then a separate question. Because for me, I will happily explain that, let's say, I don't want to be locked in with one GSI. What happens if they've got client and audit restrictions? Someone else I can work with? But in the same, equally, I don't want to work with 5, 6, 7, 8 of them. It dilutes. You can't build the deep and meaningful business case and relationship with them if you're convoluting that by trying to spread yourself too thin with too many. And it can easily be enticing. Oh, but there's one opportunity that has this one other GSI. Can we move this GSI because I've got one opportunity there? No. Like that isn't the business case to have such a heavy lift that will have an impact on all of your other partner relationships. So I think that one thing is being transparent, being key, being consistent. And another thing is that we have focused set of partners. I don't really want us to build. It's not unlimited. There's not unlimited space. That's very true. But partnerships will come and they will go. Some will move. Some will maybe fall back, and that's okay. It's an evolving place that is your partner ecosystem. But going back to is have your focus partners, be clear, be consistent, and that's the most important things to avoid building a convoluted and heavy partner go to market, because it becomes difficult to manage and you don't get the compound effects. And that's the one last point I'll say, is that partnerships offer so much compound benefit. So I we kind of say this, give, get.
Right.
I'll help them bring on, build that business case, get those first couple of projects, start to build that practice. And that starts to build the momentum so that even when we do joint marketing, it has a much bigger audience together. That when they begin to bring an opportunity, they'll start to be incentivized to bring an opportunity to us, and they'll be more willing to do it. And that you start to lose that benefit as you scale if you keep bringing on additional partners.
Got it. And once you've aligned the metrics, how do you communicate that alignment to the C-suite and to the executive leadership team?
So in terms of metrics for success,
For success, yes, that's right.
I for me, it's a case of, as much as possible working with them, work
Right.
with them on the, because I they are sponsors to your partner motion, to your partner go to market, and they are the executive that is buying into the idea that these partnerships will help us. So of course it's a case of, well, let's always be very defined on the metrics that are impacting business performance, and I gave a few examples earlier, but let's be really, really clear and prescriptive on those. And then, for example, we communicate that on a weekly basis, just what's the progress, how are we trending, how, and making sure that they were open and transparent about that. But having them at the beginning bought in to these metrics that would be very useful and beneficial to them. Well, then it's just a case of managing the cadence of I guess cadence of progress throughout the rest of the fiscal year. But I think that they're not just, yeah, they're sponsors. They're just very important stakeholders to have in a partner organization.
Right. And Stephen, especially with Pigment and Celonis, especially with their partnership team, do you use any tools or CRM tools which are like only focused for partnerships, or which we haven't heard about, and if you want to give a shout out?
That's actually, sorry, I'm smiling because this has been a very relevant and recent topic,
Right.
in Pigment. I think that, we've dabbled and we've played with tools like Reveal as an example. I think that's become quite well known. We actually, for the time being, don't have our partner portal yet. We've actually been, I'd say, I was going to say we originally called it a workaround of tools, but actually I quite like it. I think it's better than what some of the partner portals are out there at the moment. We're actually using Pigment.
Oh.
Pigment as much as possible as our own tool, which is maybe putting out there. Maybe it's a new use case. I'm not sure, but I think that of course we looked at kind of partner stack, looked at Allbound. Obviously, we use Reveal, but then I think it's then connecting, making sure that the dots are connected. ClickUp, Reveal, and then obviously for us into Pigment. But I wouldn't say that there's anything that's revolutionary here. I think that the biggest thing of value that we do that is, I wouldn't say is different to other organizations, but we just do it really well, is structural alignment. It's the buy-in of each of the go-to-market leaders on how we should work with partners. That's more valuable than any tool we could possibly have.
Got it. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I have used Reveal a bit and Crossbeam, but they're quite a number of few interesting tools. But yeah, I mean, time will tell, which of these would be very useful.
I'd like to pick your brain. I mean, Adler, is there any tools that you use or you have come across?
Yeah, no, I think other than Reveal, Crossbeam, in fact, I met up with a founder who's trying to build like a partner score, which is about scoring partners, and it gives like an anonymous survey. But I don't know too much about these tools, but I wanted to ask an expert, what are the
I
tools?
am always open, always looking. So, to be honest, like I need to know what's the art of the possible. So I'll be picking your brain. I'll have you pick someone else's brain that's listening in. Yeah. So I've certainly, I am always open-minded.
No, absolutely. And interesting thing is you're growing in Pigment, and you also have a large partnership team. I if I'm not wrong, you've got a team of 12 partnership managers. What's a right hiring process for new partnership managers for you and for your team?
The right hiring process. So in terms of the makeup of the team, of course we have we have partner ops, we have partner enablement, there's the partner managers, partner activation, partner delivery, and I think that certainly that's making up the makeup of the broader team. In terms of the right hi I mean are you looking in terms of like profile or in terms of process, in terms of how we hire, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at hiring, you know, what's the process of interviewing them or onboarding them, and you know what is sort of
Yeah, I mean,
the process.
I think it's a constant evolution that we're trying to get we're trying to get right, you know. And I think we've got a decent process at the moment whereby there's probably quite a few stakeholders internally that I want them to meet because of the importance of the cross-functional alignment. You know, I make sure that we have someone from sales and maybe another cross-functional stakeholder also meets that person. And I think it's really important from both sides because that person coming in is going to spend a lot of their time internally managing cross-functional stakeholders and equally vice versa. So I think that's generally one of the most important things. I would say never to hire in a silo, never hire within just purely the partner organization without them speaking to multiple stakeholders outside, because so much of the success is dependent on those connections back and forth. And if they can start with a good rapport and good relationship, it's great. I think in terms of onboarding, I context, context, context. I try to give as much context as possible, especially in an organization like Pigment or like a Celonis, and you're going through that kind of pressure cooker, high growth, is that you're only looking at something in transition. I mean, the company between the time I first interviewed and started grew, I think, 30% in people. 20. So it's a different organization than the one I spoke with day one, the one I joined. And so the most valuable thing you can have coming to this type of environment is provided context, also in a partner capacity. So our partner go to market, so it's young, it's say 13, 14 months old. So where was it? What's the ambition for it? What's the alignment that we have? What's the story from where we started to where we are now and where are we going? And I think that that's the best thing you can do to expedite someone's onboard, I guess in any capacity, but especially in a partner capacity.
Got interesting. And Stephen, you work with a lot of partnership managers. What's a signal for you for a good or a great partnership manager?
I don't look too hard at their backgrounds and their experience. And I'm not, like I say, I've worked with people that were SAs, that were pre-sales, that were sales, that were absolutely awesome, killer partner managers. I think that what you have to be is you have to be really curious and you've got to be strategic. You know, curious, strategic, and especially in this type of environment, like a Pigment, you're going to have to roll your sleeves up, really roll your sleeves up. And I think that if I can combine those three things, and they're not easy to measure, right? It's not easy to measure. Someone worked 2 years at a place. What do I know about how much they're going to roll their sleeves up, how their mind thinks, you know, in terms of how curious they are? Because that's the thing with partnership, is so much. And then the second point is that it's so much a relationships game, that having someone that I sense will have a high degree of integrity. It's so important. I was saying earlier about being consistent with partners, how important that is, because if you say one thing to another to one, your partnership will not have longevity. So whilst and this it's really tricky. It's really tricky to hire because you're in this environment like a Pigment. You're growing so fast. So how do you balance the longevity and the longer term nature that's partnerships? For what a partner I bring on today will be tomorrow's fruit, not today's, tomorrow's. So I balance that with the need to drive success today. And I think so it's a blend, and it's hard to boil it down with such a myriad of skills into one particular trait. But if I'm giving advice to someone that's applying for partner manager jobs, I would say take a step back, be curious, be strategic in understanding how an organization will and should partner. Take a step back and understand that. Ask a lot of questions. And at the end of the day is that just I'd say just be understanding of the role that building a good rapport in a relationship is. If you can't do it off the bat on a call, I mean, what chance have you got in front of someone else?
No, I love the answer because being curious, being strategic and rolling your sleeves is quite important. But can you determine somebody's curiosity in a 2 hour interview? I mean, it could be like the entire interview process could be like 3 hours or 4 hours, but how can you judge somebody's curiosity in such a short time?
You'll
Or do you
never get
take
it perfectly.
preference?
I'll never get it perfectly. Never perfect. But for me, for me, it's what due diligence research have you done before? Like, I mean, there's lots of publicly of information. You know, like curious to the person to learn more. What are the types of questions that they ask? Are they asking questions?
Yeah.
Oh, it's really important. Like I ask, well, maybe not so much in the podcast, you'd be asking me, but you know, before I'm asking you a lot of questions, a lot. That's just my nature. I just love to know you, your background, what you do. That does, it does come across. And for me, you marry that up, and that's why I will never make a go or no go based on my experience of interviewing someone. And I'll not speak to them once. I'll make sure I'll speak to them more than once. Because if I add up my experience with someone I trust and someone else I trust and someone else I trust, and that's why speaking with four or five people can be exceptionally valuable in these hires, where you're looking at, okay, certain degrees of objective knowledge with, okay, how would you build a partner go to market in XYZ environment? How would you look to say manage a channel conflict in this environment? Certain things are objective, but the bulk is that subjective piece. And going around different people, I'd say it's I don't want to say it's a feeling. I don't want to say that because I'm a metrics and I'm an impact person, but certainly on the curiosity piece, asking questions is something that's really important.
Got it. And Steven, I quickly want to do the top three. What's your favorite business book?
Oh, that's a difficult question. You know what? I'm gonna throw a little spanner in the work there. I'm not gonna give you a business book. I'm gonna give you a book that because of the talking about being curious. It's a book called Number by Tobias Danzig. And it looks on, because I love history, I love context, I'm very curious by nature. And I guess human psychology is something that I'm quite passionate about as well. Number is a book that delves into the history of numbers as a concept, and the psychology that numbers play in our own lives today and people's decision makings and their day to day. And I think I'll not say too much more, but have a look into it. It's certainly a really interesting read.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm going to look this up because this is the first recommendation which has come, which is quite different from what people usually say. And this is like, I've done 300 plus podcasts, so definitely going to have a look at this and going to buy this one. And you know, if you could go back in time when you started working in partnerships, what is the one thing you would have focused on or done anything differently?
Good. It's a really good question. I made a lot of mistakes, a lot, and I have no issue with that because I learned from those mistakes. I think that I think as early as possible, my biggest piece of advice to myself would have been find a partner leader that you can lean on to expedite your learnings. Find a mentor, find someone. I think a lot of I found my mistakes I made were solo and my learnings were solo. And I think that if I could have found someone to learn from, it would have expedited that journey massively.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. And finally, do you have any favorite online tools? Example, Gmail, Slack, Zoom.
Like email, Slack, Zoom.
I mean, like
in general.
In general, yeah. Anything other than Pigment, yeah.
Anything? Oh, I mean, yeah. You said it, but that's the one that comes to my mind is Slack. I don't know how I lived with Slack without Slack before. I am unfortunately the guy that when I see people, I hear people are like communicating via Teams internally. I'm like, oh God, you're missing out. You're missing out big time. Yeah. I think it's probably the most used app on my phone, which is really sad. I'm a person of convenience. I like things to be simple. I like it to be convenient, but it has to be easy to use. So no surprise, being at Celonis, being at Pigment, a great UI UX is so important for me. And especially a tool I use so much, it has to be, yeah, probably Slack.
Slack, yeah. Got it. We'll put down in the show notes. And Simon, what is the best way people can reach out to you and know more about what you do at Pigment?
Feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. I mean, I don't know if you, again, Stefan Ross, Stefan Ross, you'll probably see it, and maybe you can add the link somewhere. Feel free to connect with me, and I'm always happy to help where I can. And hopefully it's been, you know, interesting and someone's learned something out there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think this was a masterclass in partnerships, and I really enjoyed my conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, pleasure, Rohit. Thank you for having me. Real pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Life Self Mastery podcast, where we teach you how to start and grow your online business. For more information, visit Rohit's blog at www.lifeselfmastery.com.